ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What do Rasputin, Tupac, and Pharaoh Ramses III have in common? No, it's not the weirdest boy band ever. They all met their end at the hand of an assassin. From seizing power to silencing dissidents, Assassins unpacks the moments in which someone decides that murder is the move. Search for Assassins with Aslan Pahari on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
At 29, she wrote a book that you could say changed Australia. And 50 years on, Dr. Anne Summers stands as a giant of the Australian feminist movement. Today on Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, Anne joins you to reflect on the impact of her revolutionary book, Damned Whores and God's Police, the ongoing fight for gender equality and the strengths of feminism today.
I just felt so vindicated the way these young women were reacting, because we've been saying for years that we'll never be equal if we think we can just add on equality to all the things we always do. We have to actually change things, and we have to get the men to do their share, or we have to make it their share. And, you know, while everybody agrees with that in principle, it's very, very rare that that's been achieved.
Yes, there's still work to do, but it's also important to reflect on how much has been achieved. Because when Damned Whores and God's Police, Anne's book, was published in 1975, Australia had no Sex Discrimination Act. Family violence and sexual harassment were legal, and few women walked the halls of power. We've got a long way to go there yet. Dr. Anne Summers was a pioneer in the women's liberation movement. At the time, she co-founded one of Australia's first women's refuges for women fleeing domestic violence, the Elsie Refuge. She went on to advise Prime Ministers Bob Hawke and Paul Keating on the needs of women. She edited that iconic feminist magazine, Ms. Magazine. And later, back in Australia, she became editor of The Good Weekend. Today, Anne is recognised as a leading authority on domestic and family violence. Let's join her at the Sydney Writers' Festival with Alicia Simmons, who is an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Technology, Sydney. His latest book is called Courting, An Intimate History of Love and the Law. Take it away.
So I'd like to introduce this session by setting the scene and taking us back to the mid-1970s, when Anne Summers, then only, I thought 30, but you corrected me recently, 27 when you finished the book?
30 when it was published. I was about 29 when I finished it.
29-year-old Anne Summers is sitting at her desk in an inner-city share house, affectionately called the Cockroach Castle, and penned the final words of a book that she had been working on for 4 years. A book that will make Australian history by doing something at once revolutionary and now quite obvious. Anne included women in the national story. If we were to peer outside the window of that room, we'd find a world that most young people today would struggle to recognise. There's neither state nor federal legislation outlawing discrimination. Equal pay has only just been introduced between 74 and 76. There's yet to be a name for domestic violence, for sexual harassment, gender pay gap, be no female premiers, no prime ministers, no female high court judges. In Damned Whores and God's Police, which I think is a work of sociology and journalism as much as of history, Anne paints a really evocative picture, I think, of this world. She says, you know, it's a world of beauty contests and newspaper stories describing women by her sexual attributes. It's a world where women can't walk in crowded city streets without being wolf whistled or catcalled. In groups, men harass women, declarations of menacing intent. On a happier note, the women's liberation movement is now in full swing. Gough Whitlam, the first PM to commit to a feminist agenda, has spent 3 years in office, and 29-year-old Anne Summers, who has just helped to establish ELSI, the very first women's refuge in Australia, Refractory Girl, the first women's studies journal, has now also written a book that will inspire a fairer, more just and more equal future for Australian women by changing forever the way that we understand women's lives, Australian women's lives in the past. I confess it had been quite a while since I first read Damned Whores and God's Police, and when I dipped back into it to prepare for this event, I found myself once again awestruck by the extraordinary scope of this book. It's a book that is one at once microscopic, as you saw just even in that last example that I gave you, and epic. It's written by someone with an omnivorous intellectual appetite who brought her activism and her scholarship together to solve a puzzle. How did Australian national identity and culture come to be so deeply embedded in masculinist values? The prose is at once precise and poetic, personal and empirical, deeply theoretical yet wonderfully accessible. Moments of wit, irreverence, profundity, and I would say brilliance really abound. Anne did not just want to change the world, she wanted to understand it, to dig up the historical origins and causes of women's oppression. Her conclusions were startlingly original, and they lay the bedrock for all future research, not just in feminist history, but I would say in Australian history. To condense what is now a 750-page doorstopper into a few sentences, I'd say that the central argument of the book is, and I quote, that Australian women have been defined and constrained by stereotypes that both prescribed and proscribed certain ways of being. The first 50 years of colonisation in this country gave rise to, and I quote, a particularly rigid, dualistic notion of women's function in society. They could be God's police, or women who conform to the wife-mother role, or they could be damned whores, women who transgress the norms of femininity, both socially and sexually. These stereotypes, which have their origins in the nuclear family unit, have kept women in check. They've made motherhood and family their ultimate aspiration and subjected those who refuse to social exclusion, castigated as damned whores. Australian women will never be free, Summers argued, until they escape their characterisation as whores or mothers. I think one of the things that kept coming up every time that I spoke to friends about doing this were the lines, it still stands up today, doesn't it? You know, it's still just tragically still so relevant. So Anne, look, I want to go back in time. Every time I read about you writing Damned Whores, the story starts with you in your early 20s, you know, at Cockroach Palace and these theories of women's liberation kind of trickling through from the US and you being very excited about that. But I'm wondering what it was in your earlier life, growing up in a strict Catholic family in Deniliquin, and also your later life in Melbourne, Adelaide, that made you particularly receptive to feminism.
I actually grew up in Adelaide. Born in Deniliquin.
Born in Deniliquin.
Proud Denny girl, but left at the age of 3 months.
Right.
So, okay. So my claim to be a Denny girl is slightly tenuous. Although we used to go back there every Christmas holidays to see the grandparents. But Adelaide is where I grew up, and Adelaide is a particularly prurient city, it certainly was in those days, and one where the constraints on women, I think, were especially felt. And I certainly felt them through my family and through, I was the only girl in a family of six. I had five brothers and I was the only girl and the whole family revolved around the boys.
Oh, wow.
Even though I was actually the brightest one in terms of academic achievement, but we all had to move house to the other side of the city so the boys could go to the Jesuits and I had to catch two buses to get to my school and they could just walk around the corner. But that's the way it was back then. And, of course, there was no question that I would go to university or anything like that as soon as I was 16, I was out the door and get a job. All that I was expected to do was to find myself a nice doctor or lawyer to marry. There was no suggestion I'd become a doctor or a lawyer myself. What a stupid thought. So I mean, it was just all laid down for us. And one of the things that I remember very clearly as a young girl, I was probably about 14 or 15, there was a dreadful moral panic in Adelaide because of the rise of this group of people. And I don't know whether anyone here will remember them because I don't know if it was a specifically Adelaide phenomenon or not. Bodgies and Widgies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Remember? Okay. Well, my mother was extremely worried that I would become a Widgie.
Right.
And I think what Widgies, it's very hard to describe Widgies, but they used to wear white, black stockings and white lipstick and dye their hair black. I mean, today you call them goths.
Goth,
or used to be called bohemians, I don't know. But I do remember my mother going to a seminar held by the police and she came home with all these brochures about how to detect whether or not your daughter was becoming a Widgie. And I read these avidly. How can I become a Widgie? It sounded so exciting. And I guess that's what I've been aiming for ever since.
Yes. So unfortunately, you didn't become a Widgie. Instead, you moved to Balmain and you became...
Much later. I did go to Adelaide University.
Adelaide Uni.
Yeah, for a few years. For enough years to get a degree.
And then started your PhD...
And then went to Sydney.
Sydney, yeah.
I started my PhD. I actually started at the University of New South Wales, didn't get on with the powers that be there, and I moved to Sydney Uni, which was the greatest thing I ever did because that's where I met Henry Mayer, who was my professor and the person who looked after me and who made sure this book got written. I was signed up to write a PhD. And Henry was a very unusual man. I'm sure some people in this audience will know him, remember him. He was a De Niro boy. He was a young Jewish boy who escaped from Germany, lived in London for a while, was rounded up and put on the De Niro and sent to Australia along with many, many other Jewish men and then imprisoned in Hay internment camp for some years until after the end of the war. But he became a professor of government, but he was very interested in the student movement in the United States in the 60s, very interested in theories of revolution, very interested in Herbert Marcuse, and he encouraged us students to read these books and to be interested in them. And so at the same time as I was being influenced by the women's movement, I was also being influenced by these theories of liberation from other movements. And he was very impressed by my writings and my ideas, and he encouraged me. And he said to me at some point, because I was writing about women, and everybody said to me, I mean, not everybody but him said to me, now, if you want to have a career in academia, which had never occurred to me, you've got to give this away. You know, you can't write about women. I mean, that's a dead-end subject. And I thought, well, but I'm interested in it. So I do want to write about them, or not about them, but I want to understand certain things. So Henry said to me, he said, look, the world is full of libraries with dusty PhDs rotting away. Mm. He said, the world needs this book. And so he not only encouraged me and minutely, you know, edited and criticised the crap out of it. I'd send him a chapter to come back so annotated with more words, more of his words than mine. So he was such an intense critic. It was because he was so excited about what I was trying to do. But the great thing that he did for me, and I can dob him in now because he's no longer with us, so they can't do anything about it, is that he used to sign a declaration from the Department of Education solemnly swearing that I was completing all the requirements for a PhD, and so I got paid every month, which enabled me to survive while I actually was writing a book. And that went on for 4 years.
Wow.
Which was amazing. Fantastic. But, I mean, the thing that really interested me and got me going on this book was, you know, trying to make sense of all the things that were happening in the world. I mean, not just the unfairness and the injustice and all the things that girls couldn't do back then, or the excitement of the women's liberation movement and all this stuff. This was back in the days when, you know, you didn't have a phone, you could pick up and see what happened in New York 3 seconds ago. Mm. You had to wait for the mail to arrive. So it would take 6 weeks before the latest, you know, the myth of the vaginal orgasm pamphlet reached us.
Amazing.
Very interested in that one. And many others, of course. But I do remember a day at Adelaide University where we made some Xerox copies or mimeographed copies of that particular pamphlet, and we went around campus nailing copies of it to trees.
That's great.
And we were followed by a group of engineering students who ripped them, ripped them down with a little more vigour than was required. But what really got me going was that we were getting all this great stuff from America in particular, and also from the UK, and Kate Millett's book, you know, Robin Morgan's Sisterhood is Powerful, Shulamith Firestone's The Dialectic of Sex. So many wonderful books, so many incredible ideas. The Boston Women's Health Collective, you know, Our Bodies, Ourselves. All these ideas exploding the myths that we'd been brought up to believe were the natural order of things. Sheila Rowbotham in the UK, Juliet Mitchell. The thing that struck me about these books was I thought they were fantastic. I devoured every word. But they weren't talking to me about my country and my culture. And it seemed to me that we needed to understand, or I wanted to understand, why it was we were the way we were. The particularly Australian forms of, we didn't even use the word sexism back then, it was all male chauvinism. But how was it that we had become the way we were? Because our oppression, if you like, the way that we were made to act differently as women was different from the girls in the States and different from the girls in England. You just knew that by reading fiction, that the lives are different. And I was trying to grapple with what it was, and I wasn't sure. But then I was fortuitous. Henry introduced me to John Hooker, who was the publisher of Penguin Books, and he and I sat down at the also at University of New South Wales, and we sat down at the refectory there for about 5 hours and smoked about a million cigarettes and drank lots of cups of tea. Mm-hmm. And while I ear-bashed him about my theories, and my main theory was that it was all to do with mateship. Hmm. And I didn't quite know why, but if he gave me some money to write the book, I would be able to explain it all to him. And amazingly, he bought it and I got an advance. I think it was $1,500, which was an absolute fortune back then. And I went on and I said he'd have the book in 6 months. Well, as we know, the book ended up not being about mateship, although that's one of the things that's in it. But that was sort of my starting point. The starting point, the question was, what is it about Australia that's different? How are we the way we are? Mm. And so that was the question that I pursued for 4 years, both in libraries, looking at primary sources, also looking at reading as much as I could. I mean, I read all the great Australian men of history, all using the word men advisedly, read all the great men of Australian literature, you know, Patrick White, et cetera, read everything I could read, and then started reading all the young Turks, you know, David Williamson, you know, Oz magazine, all these radical young men and what they were doing. Wasn't that fabulous? Well, yes, but we weren't included in any of it. We talk about Whitlam government. We were thrilled the Whitlam government was elected. Not a single woman, but we were so excited for the success of others. So we'd learned to take pleasure in other people's success. We hadn't yet learned how to seek our own achievements and accomplishments and enjoyments. And so what I tried to find out by reading our history and reading our literature and delving into our culture, looking at our sport, looking at everything. I mean, when we talk about the book being a history book, I reject that. I don't think it's a history book. The first line of the book is, this is a book about Australia. And it was a book about, it included the history, it included sociology, it included everything, but it was about Australia, who we are and how we are and how we became that way. And it was doing that work that led me to the conclusion that we were exhibiting a form of the traditional ways in which women have been divided in every Western culture immemorial into Madonnas or whores. Mm. And I've never been more excited in my life. And when I came across the phrase damned whores in the Mitchell Library, reading Lieutenant Ralph Clark's journal of the First Fleet and his comment on the female convicts as damned whores, I thought, yes, widgies. But then, you know, I had to read a lot about the convicts and the fact that they were damned whores. They'd been forced into whoredom. They were explicitly brought out here to sexually service the needs of the male convicts and the male colonists. And then they were condemned for doing it. And then, of course, the other phrase I came across was God's Police, which was by Caroline Chisholm, who was a middle-class woman who ran a middle-class women's female immigration society, and her job was to bring out nice, respectable girls from England to marry the wild colonial boys, dampen them all down, create a nice bourgeois society that we still enjoy, and that was our role, and we've fulfilled it more or less willingly ever since.
She's been questioning, she's been challenging, repositioning, fighting for the role of women in Australian society for five decades. And Anne Summers joins you today here on Big Ideas across the country on ABC Radio National, and you can hear us on the ABC Listen app too. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Anne is with an audience at the Sydney Writers' Festival and the host, Alicia Simmons, remembering the process of writing her groundbreaking book, Damned Whores and God's Police, as a PhD student in her late 20s. That's now 50 years ago.
I have to confess, and I find that so interesting, that ideological background. But before coming in here today, Anne told me and what I think is quite an extraordinary story about the actual material conditions under which the book was written, where you were living, what happened in the... Can you just share some of that with the audience?
It did take 4 years.
Yeah.
So I lived in various places. When I started out, I was living in a very palatial place in Wharf Road in Birchgrove, which was actually fantastic. Nice. Very nice. Had a little apartment in part of a bigger house. And the photograph of me that's on the final edition, here are all the editions of the book over the years, and the final one published by New South in 2016. I'm very grateful to them for making sure that it didn't die. It's still going. The photograph on that cover was taken by Carol Jerrams at Wharf Road. That's where I started writing the book. But I went down in the world and moved to the Cockroach Castles, which is in the Johnston Street, East Balmain, where I had a horrible room with seagrass matting, and it was disgusting. But then I kept going down in the world because I really didn't have much money, and I ended up for a while living in my car, and I had to sort of find places to write during the day so I could go to the Mitchell Library. And then at the very end... I was Liz Phil, who lived in Paddington. She gave me a room in her house. I used to go there and sleep. But I used to work during the book, and some friends had a restaurant in Paddington at Five Ways, and they had an empty room upstairs in the restaurant. There was a table there, so I used to work at the table in the restaurant, and that was just me and my typewriter, and I had this really tinny tape recorder. Mm. And I used to play cassettes of Joni Mitchell.
It's amazing. That's great.
While I typed away.
How did you imagine it would be received at the time? What were your hopes? What were your fears? I'm just imagining the engineering students following you around the campus. What about the engineering students?
Well, by then I'd moved to Sydney and I was in the push, and I
you didn't
never gave that. The engineering students another thought, I can tell you.
The metaphorical engineering student.
I mean, the biggest issue for me was whether or not I could finish this book.
Yeah.
Because I was so scared of it. And I really doubted whether or not I could do it.
Right.
I really doubted that I had the gumption to take on the great men of Australian history, the great men of Australian literature, the great men of Australian politics. Yeah. I was just a, you know, girl, 29, 27-year-old girl. How did I dare do that? And I don't know how I did, actually. I really don't know how I did it, but I did. Mm. But I was terrified of finishing it. And it's not just the usual fear of finishing that every author has, but it was more than that, because I felt the consequences of telling Australia that everything about us was wrong, and we had to change, and we had to start including women, and we had to stop being so horrible. Mm. I was sort of worried about how that might work out. I didn't know if it would be well received. I mean, the publishers were very enthusiastic, so that was good. And it was Penguin, a very major publisher. I was so excited to be a potential Penguin author. But I didn't really know. The only thing that gave me comfort is that I knew I wasn't completely mad, because everybody I knew felt the same way. I mean, we were all having the same conversations. We were all making the same critiques. Mm. We were all experiencing the same anger and rejection and all the rest of it. So there were going to be a few hundred people at least who I hoped would buy it because I knew they agreed with it. But we really didn't know. And when it came out, it got fantastic reviews, which was amazing, from the capitalist press, as we used to call it, before I went to work for it. and the Sydney Morning Herald had, The Age, had Manning Clark review it, and he gave it a fantastic review, and that was just extraordinary. I could not believe it. Most of the critical reviews were actually from women and from other feminists, which was a little bit disappointing. I sort of now realised that they were doing me the favour of giving me a proper critique of what I'd done, whereas to me, you know, a good review was an adoring review that could find absolutely nothing wrong with what you'd written, and that wasn't the way it worked, of course. Yeah. But it did... this is the history of the book. This was the first edition, the very first edition, published in 1975, and it was published, and there was also a hard copy published. It was called, like this, was called a library edition. It was never on sale. It was only sold to libraries. There's 1,000 copies. And it kept on getting printed and printed. And this was the ninth printing, and that was in 1990. So then it went into this edition in 2002, I think it was. I don't really like that cover very much. And then the purple and green one, which is hiding back there, a bit hard to see, but I know that's the one that a lot of people read at university. And then, that one. So it's been through a lot of editions, and each one I've added new material to try and keep the book alive by trying to look at how things have changed in the period since the last edition. Also added new material, timeline of women's achievements and that kind of thing. Mm. And then, of course, the infamous letter to the next generation.
I was just about to ask about that.
Mm. Well, that's in the purple and silver one. And anyone here remember that? Yes? No?
Tell us about it.
Well, at the time, I went and reread that the other day, and I was actually surprised because the rage that generated when it was first published was just quite extraordinary. But then I remember that the version that appears in the book is somewhat different from the version that I published in Good Weekend magazine. And I was the editor of Good Weekend, and so I could publish what I liked. And for this particular International Women's Day, I've published a whole lot of things, but this was one of them. It's a letter to the next generation saying to the... And I specifically addressed it to women who'd been born since 1966, I think I was, and said, you know, where are you? What are you doing? When are you going to pick up the torch? You know, there's so much to be done. You know, we did so much, but there is so much still to be done. Things are getting worse. Violence is getting worse. Why aren't you up there picking up the torch? Or if you are, you know, why don't you bloody all hurry up? You know, I was quite confrontational and quite intemperate in my language. And there was absolute riot. I got more than 300 letters from angry young women telling me what they thought of me. I'm sure some of you are here and I'm sure that's why your response was a little low-key because so... But what is so funny about it, or not funny but interesting about it, is that, you know, there was in fact a lot of things happening, but they were invisible to the outside world because they were kind of on campus or they were in small communities. And I said, you know, it's no good doing stuff that no one knows about. You know, everyone knew what we were doing because we were very out there, down the street, you know, misses a vaginal orgasm on the trees in front of the library at uni, so you couldn't miss it. So no good publishing a little magazine and just spreading it around the pub with your friends. Anyway, so we had that fight. But what was so great about it was that it led to at least 5 books being published, including one by Kathy Bale, who is now the publisher of this edition of the book. She's the publisher of New South, and she published a book called Generation DIY Feminism. Thank you so much. Why do I blank on that? Virginia Trioli published the other one.
Generation F.
And I remember I published a photograph of both Kathy and Virginia on the cover of Good Weekend because we covered the letter, but we had covered the aftermath of the letter as well because there were so many angry replies came in. I see more than 300 letters altogether, a lot of them from very well-known women who were very well-known then and some who are still very well-known. And, in fact, the person who springs most to mind is Tanya Pupasek, who wrote a very angry letter. Anyway, she's done all right. all of those letters are in the National Library, and if you're in Canberra and want to have a look at them, you can go and ask for them. So, you know, that was kind of a little bit of history within the history of the book, if you like. A little bit of activism sort of jumped out of the pages, and I'm still... completely unrepentant.
Good.
For having done that.
The 1990s feminists. But that's the thing. I mean, you know, as we've discussed before, you couldn't say that now about this generation of young women. And that's the interesting part I find with this book is this one's published in 2016, which is just on the cusp of the Me Too movement. And since then, you've seen an extraordinary reinvigoration of the feminist movement. What would a letter to the next generation look like now? What are the kind of priorities that you could see? And I've got a few questions that are like that as well, you know?
Okay.
What are your thoughts for current trends, such as tradwife? Any advice for tactfully calling this out? What are the biggest challenges facing Australian women today? Mm. So if we were to update that, you know, sort of 10 years ago.
Well, I mean, I do agree that today's generation of young women, so I'm talking about women in their 20s and teens and 20s, are probably as radical as we were. And they're certainly more radical than some of the intervening generations. And that is really fantastic to see. And I think one of the things that's really good about it is that one of the things that used to annoy me in the 90s is so many women would say, I'm a feminist, but. So, you know, you just take the bits you'd like, but you didn't want, you know, to face any problems or issues. These girls today, young women today, are not like that. They are very, very enthusiastic. And I went to an event in the All About Women Festival at Sydney Opera House in March this year. It was a session called The Baby Bust, and it was all about fertility and whether or not women are still wanting to have children. If so, why? And if not, why not? And it was extraordinary. It was absolutely packed. The Gentleman Theatre was packed, so you know, about 1,000 women, all young. Mm. And their militancy and the way they expressed their fact that they were not going to be forced to give up their lives to have children was extraordinary. Mm. And one of the women who spoke on stage had said she and her husband had spent years trying to decide whether or not they would have children. And in the end, they have decided that they will. They still haven't, but they're about to. But that she insisted that they sign a contract, a new contract, like their marriage vows, in which he will undertake to share every single part of the job of raising that child. She will not breastfeed because that is not something they can share. So it's now no longer love, honour and obey. Mm. It's love, honour and share all the bloody work. It's really interesting. I just felt so vindicated the way these young women were reacting because we've been saying for years that we'll never be equal if we think we can just add on equality to all the things we always do. We have to actually change things and we have to get the men to do their share or we have to make it their share. And, you know, while everybody agrees with that in principle, it's very, very rare that that's been achieved. So it was quite interesting to hear this young woman say that and to hear the extraordinary applause that she received from the audience. So young women they're aware of the preconditions for freedom, I think, in ways that have taken a long time to sort of get understood.
And you can actually hear that conversation that Anne refers to in a previous edition of Big Ideas, The Baby Boycott, from this year's fabulous All About Women Festival at the Sydney Opera House. And we will link to that in the show notes for this episode. You're with Big Ideas, our live event show brought to you by ABC Radio National. Find us on the ABC Listen app or podcast us however you like. We're with influential Australian feminist Anne Summers today. And host, author and law professor Alicia Simmons. They're weaving in some questions from the audience now and marking 50 years since the publication of Anne's legendary book, Damned Whores and God's Police, back in 1975, and reflecting on where we're at with gender relations and equality today in 2025.
One of the questions that I've got here is, who are the Summers and Firestones of 2025? So staying with now, are there any authors or commentators that you're excited about? Look, I think related to that, so we can have that, but we could also ask, who are the damned whores and God's police of today?
I don't want to be unfair about I don't read that much at the moment because I'm very preoccupied with work I'm doing on domestic violence, so I'm not keeping up with feminist theory the way I should be. And sure. I got into trouble recently for not being familiar with the works of Judith Butler. Sorry. and various other people. And there are current debates that I really am not across, and I'm not really sorry because I don't need to be. I'm doing other stuff, you know. You can't do everything. Mm. Back in the early days, you could be across everything because there wasn't that much to be across. You know, there are only three or four books that you could. They're pretty big though. it's very different. But I mean, I think the stereotypes are still with us.
Mm.
They vary, and to some extent they're self-imposed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of Australian women still like the idea of being God's police. Now, whether they're called yummy mummies or chad wives or whatever, there is still a very strong tendency among a lot of women to be, because it's the only area of social life where they get approbation, where they get praise, where they're rewarded. Is by being the champions of their family, the guardians of their family, looking after, making sure they raise their children to be the right sort of people. So that's a role that we still cherish in Australia. And you know, it's a role that, you know, if you look back to the time of John Howard as Prime Minister, I mean, he absolutely deified that role. He embedded it in our tax system.
Mm.
He embedded it in so much social policy that we still haven't changed. Hello, Albo. With your 93 seats, a lot of things you can do now that perhaps couldn't be done before. But, I mean, the tax system still rewards the women who work and have children. I mean, it punishes women who work and have children. Mm. Still does that. So we have to change our policies so that women's choices are real choices. They're not loaded choices. So while we've done some great things in the last couple of years with paid parental leave, paying super on paid parental leave, we're moving towards universal childcare. I mean, all of that is necessary and terrific, but we still haven't quite got into that part of the brain where women think, well, in order to be really valued by this society, I have to fulfil my primary role, which is to be a really good mother.
Surely there's a shadow history to all this as well, and a shadow conversation about shifts in masculinity. You know, part of the reason why women think that is partly because we don't have paid paternity leave to the same extent. What do you think about the current state of discourses of masculinity in the world at the moment, in Australia, compared with, you know, when you were writing?
Well, it's changed a lot. I mean, it's very scary in some ways. I mean, there is no doubt there is a backlash, a huge backlash at the moment, particularly amongst younger men. And there is, I mean, it's a very complex sort of subject, and we could spend a long time talking about it. But I mean, the things that are very apparent is there is a huge resentment by a lot of men that women earn more than they earn or that they earn anything at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just produced a report as part of my current job called The Cost, and it's the cost to women's employment and women's education of domestic violence, in which we produce data that's not previously been made public that shows that women who experience domestic violence are less likely to be employed or to earn less. There's something like 10% of university students who experience domestic violence and will leave their degrees without completion, and therefore any opportunity to make decent money over their lifetimes, often still saddled with a hex debt. But there is no doubt that there is, we document in that report huge numbers of men who actively prevent their wives and girlfriends from studying or from working.
Wow.
This is in 2025. And that to me is terrifying. Mm. There is a huge amount of domestic violence. I mean, this is a form of domestic violence. It's a form of economic violence, preventing women from pursuing study or work. But it's associated with other forms of violence as well. It's associated with a massive increase in stalking, both physical stalking and electronic stalking, you know, use of phones and what have you, which is something the police comment on a lot. And again, this stalking is a form of surveillance to ensure that women are doing what they should be doing. The forms of control that are being used against women, like, you know, stop mechanisms on their cars so they can only drive to the shops and no further, that kind of thing. The use of electronic mechanisms so they can't open the fridge and they can't eat all day, or, you know, the suddenly the music goes on really loud and they can't turn it off. Okay. You know, there's just horrifying things. You know, tracking devices in kids' toys, all that stuff is happening and getting worse, getting much, much worse. And so, you know, we have to conclude from that that there is tremendous resentment by some men, certainly not all men, not all men at all, but by some men, at the fact that women are having choices and the ability to lead better lives than they had in the past. Mm. The thing is exacerbated, I think, with young men's use of pornography, which is very, very widespread, seems to be getting worse. I mean, pornography is accessible in ways that are just, like, mind-blowing. You know, it's just like on everyone's phone, whereas once you'd have to, you know, have to have the guts to go to the newsagent and go down the back and get parts of the shelves where the things were covered in plastic and you'd have to surreptitiously go up there and buy it. You don't have to do it. There's no shame anymore. There's no risk involved. You just, it's all there. Mm-hmm. And we know from, well, you tell me the story of your students and their reaction to this.
Well, I find it really interesting. I actually, as part of the course that I teach on law and philosophy, I teach feminist theory as part of that. And one of the things that I found really interesting over the last 10 years is the extent to which my students have come to love Catherine MacKinnon, and particularly her writing on pornography. And I was saying to Anne, it's interesting for me because I remember going through uni and also loving her, but being very much on the outer in so doing. She was considered to be a bit of a killjoy. She was a censor. She tried to, you know, to actually enact legislation prohibiting pornography. And most people of my generation, which is the kind of slut walk sort of generation, really were down on her. Whereas I now find when I teach, and in fact I have a bunch of student essays that have just come in, almost all of them are on pornography, all of them, so many of them by women and men, and these are kids aged between sort of 18 and 25, are saying we need to do something about it, we need to regulate it in some way, that they write on deep fake pornography. And their argument is, and they're correct in this, that there is a direct link between pornography and domestic violence. You know, if
but also the ways in which they are being treated sexually.
And sorry, exactly, the way that they're being treated sexually. The interesting thing I think about this generation is that they have come to learn about sex through a screen first. You know, so to that extent, their sexual imagination has been completely colonized, you know, by pornography. And the girls themselves say, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of them who in more private moments say, I don't want to have sex. It's not fun. Like, you know, it's painful for them. It's awful, you know, because of the extent to which boys, and I think girls are also encouraged to do this, follow these scripts of like sexual torture, of
strangulation.
Really strangulation. So the increases in strangulation as part of domestic violence have, you know, has gone through the roof in the last sort of 10 years. And it's directly correlated to the proliferation of pornography on the internet. So I think one of the arguments that you can make now is not, you know, when Catherine MacKinnon first wrote that, people were saying, oh, well, you can't really say this. Your database is too small. How do we know? Who even watches porn? You know, these days it's like, well, we do know. You know, it's out there. Everyone's, you know, so many people are watching it. And the results are catastrophic. You know, we need to do something about it. So on this outside, thing, this there's thing a is, generation of girls who are really onto it, and boys, yeah. You know, the guys are great.
But this whole thing about the red pilling of young boys and the, yeah. You know, this
Andrew Tate,
all that stuff. I mean, that's very real. Even ASIO, the head of ASIO has talked about that as a risk. This is it takes, you know, 3 weeks or something to radicalise a young man, and they're not just talking about terrorism in the conventional sense, they're talking about domestic terrorism.
Absolutely.
That it takes such a short time to do it. And we know that Jess Hill, who's written a brilliant quarterly essay called Losing It, which I would really urge you all to read it. It's just so, so good. She did a little exercise of pretending to be a 15-year-old boy online for a few weeks to get all this stuff. And she said, it took about a week before they were, she was getting the material, and it just escalated and escalated and escalated. And the attitudes that are being inculcated against women into these young boys So they end up being little hate machines. And I mean, you're seeing it in crime all the time. You're seeing it in their public actions, apart from whatever they're doing privately. You know, it's really, really horrifying. And so that's one of the downsides of our women's revolution. And it's not one that we're responsible for, but it's one that we have to deal with. And it's a very, very big challenge, I think.
Look, one of the questions that I've got here is, well, what should we do? What do you think that federal and state governments should do to improve the status of women in Australia? I mean, it's a big question, but it's a kind of, you know...
Yeah, well, it's a very complex question. There are lots of things we can do and lots of things we are doing and lots of things have been done. And the thing is that the agenda keeps kind of changing and moving because we discover new things. I mean, as I said, when I wrote this book in 1975, the term sexual harassment didn't exist. The term date rape didn't exist. The term domestic violence didn't exist. It's not that the things didn't exist, but we hadn't named them. You know, you have to name things, you have to understand them before you can deal with them. So as we've progressed and as we've learned more and as we've achieved some really great results in a lot of areas, new areas seem to arise that need to be dealt with or that we... There's unfinished business. I mean, I was shocked when you told me before in the green room that it wasn't until 1997 that Australian women got jury duty.
Yeah, it took until 1997 for all states in Australia to give women equal rights to men to sit on the jury.
And now all we want to do is get out of it.
So, it's a thing with an obligation rather than a right. It's kind of boring.
But, I mean, there is, you know, there are new things that arise. And, I mean, this current state of fight back, if you like, by men is one of the new things that we're having to deal with. But in terms of women's entitlements, I mean, I mentioned before about the tax system needs to change. Women's pay, we still don't have equal pay. I mean, it's getting slightly better in some areas, but we still do not have equal pay, and that is just outrageous. So, I mean, that's something that has to change. And domestic violence, I mean, is a huge, huge challenge. And we've got to develop a more sophisticated approach to it. It's not just one form of domestic violence. There are many different forms, and I mentioned some of them before, and they each require different types of response. And I think, you know, we're getting to the point where we understand that, and we do have some very good people working in the area. But, it, you know, it's going to take... It's a very, very hard thing to change.
Absolutely. And you've spent quite a bit of your life working in the US or going back and forth from the US as editor of Ms. Magazine. There's a part of me that wants to not talk about Trump, but I'd be really interested in your opinion of what's going on, like what on the status of the feminist movement in the US or gender politics there. Some thoughts.
Well, I mean, losing Roe v. Wade was just... I won't even say the beginning of the end. It was like, you know, it was the end. What has happened there is that there is no longer a federal protection of abortion, so it's up to individual states. And I forget, you know, the breakdown of states, but basically abortion is only available now legally in a very small number of states. And those states that are against abortion are going to such extraordinary lengths to enforce that law and to prevent women from travelling to other states to get abortions. And they're spreading. It's the fact that it's more than about just stopping women having abortions. It's you know, women are being charged with murder for having miscarriages. Contraception is being is being banned. It's now impossible to send IU486 through the mail. So, you know, that we're moving towards a Gilead or, as you know, as Margaret Atwood's book was, you know, documentary, basically, to what's happening. So that's one thing. I mean, and this expunging of gender. I mean, the word gender has been expunged from the US vocabulary, and so are women. I mean, the sacking of women, the sacking of the this is just one example, but the sacking of the Librarian of Congress. She had been appointed, it was a 10-year appointment. She had been appointed just 2 years ago, for 10 years by a Republican-controlled Senate. And she was fired summarily by Trump for no other reason, or for two reasons. One, that she was a woman, technically she was black. And fortunately, even Congress is starting to object to that because this is an incursion into their areas that they're finally starting to object to. But they've gone through the Pentagon, you know, and they gone through the Pentagon archives and libraries and expunged all the photos, all the women, you know, who fought in the wars. They've expunged all the black people who fought in the wars. And there was one sort of hilarious incident where they got rid of all the photographs of Enola Gay. And they're thinking it was... not realising it was the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. So they do some pretty stupid things too. But you know, their intent is very evil. It's evil, it's dangerous, it's they are absolutely... There is no moral boundary that contains them. I mean, all this stuff they're doing in the Middle East, I mean, the presidency is for sale. We've seen that. And the amount of money that Trump and his family are making out of the presidency is just horrendous. At the same time that they're introducing a piece of legislation which is formally called a Big Beautiful Bill, which is going to be cutting Medicare for thousands of people while cutting taxes for the rich. These sorts of things are happening with very little pushback. Mm. I don't know what the Women's Movement is doing. I have no idea. Mm. They're very silent. Mm. Absolutely. And, you know, they just haven't had the experience in fighting government that we've had. Mm. You know, one of my criticisms of the Women's Movement in America back years ago when I lived there, when I ran MIS, was that they never had the pragmatism that the Australian Women's Movement had. And they, you know, we got the Sex Discrimination Act in 1984, they still don't have the ERA and they'll never get it because they didn't know, they weren't willing to be pragmatic. They weren't willing to accept compromises. That to be perfect. Mm. Now, we accepted the Sex Discrimination Act with 17 amendments, some of which were very hard to swallow at the time. But we did it and, you know, within a few years, all of them had gone. All of those amendments have gone and we've added further things to the bill and made it even better. I'm not saying it's perfect legislation, but it does provide an enormous degree of protection for women and men against discrimination. And you made the point before about 2016 being the year of Me Too, and a lot of people made the point that Me Too never really took off in Australia, and we don't have the sort of the famous scalps that the Americans have got. We don't have our Harvey Weinstein and people like that. What people don't realise is that sexual harassment was outlawed in the 1984 bill, in the first version of the Sex Discrimination Act, and that women have been making claims against their bosses or against their co-workers of sexual harassment in the workplace ever since, and many of them getting very considerable financial payouts. So we mightn't have the big names, but we've had a lot of justice and a lot of financial recompense. So we do things differently here, which is where we started off. I wanted to know why we did things differently here. Mm. The things that upset me back then, you know, I thought were pretty bad. There are many things now that we can be quite proud of that we do differently here, and that's one of them.
Yep. Absolutely.
Perfect timing.
Now, unfortunately, we are absolutely at time. So I'd like you to join me in thanking.
Thank you for coming out in the rain.
Once again.
And thank you to the pioneering Ann Summers, feminist, family violence scholar, journalist, editor, author of that important book, that defining book for Australia, Damned Whores and God's Police, still in print 50 years after it was first published. Anne was speaking with Alicia Simmons, Associate Professor in Law at the University of Technology, Sydney. She's author of Courting, an intimate history of love and the law. And that conversation was recorded live at the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival. Big thanks to its team. And last year, Big Ideas broadcast a really wonderful conversation with some of the matriarchs of the women's refuge movement, of which Ann Summers was a central figure back in the 70s. And we'll link to that in our show notes. It's a conversation that might restore some of your faith in humanity if it's ailing a little at this moment. Now, on the next episode of Big Ideas, join me, Natasha Mitchell, with ABC Radio National's Citizen Jury. This one I hosted this past week in the Huon Valley of Lutruwita, Tasmania, where three citizen jurors were thrashing out the ways to reduce the environmental impact of the $1 billion salmon industry in the state, a controversial issue. and it was a packed hall, a passionate audience of locals, and citizen-driven democracy in action. Don't miss it. That's next on Big Ideas, Citizen Jury with me, Natasha Mitchell.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.